This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. It is The Bigger Picture. Welcome to the show. It has been argued that the order of one's birth can impact everything from the child's intelligence to a boy's sexual orientation. And it is almost taken for granted by many that birth order affects a child's personality. But are there really any scientific research with strong evidence to support these claims? Well, Assistant Professor Lucy Bailey, she's specialized in sociologist. She's a sociologist of education, whatever that means, Dr. Lucy. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you.
What does that mean? Sociologist of education?
I'm a sociologist, which means I look at how social structures and social processes impact on social outcomes. So, for example, in education, is the education level that a child reaches affected by the socioeconomic status of their parents? Mm-hmm. Is it affected by their gender, their ethnicity, and so on? And if so, in what ways? And more importantly, what can we do about that? How can we ensure that everyone has equal access to education, no matter what the background is that they come from?
The whole nature versus nurture thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. And what led you to research birth orders?
I'm primarily interested in parenting practices and how they impact on education, how mm-hmm. they impact on the classroom. I became interested in this at PhD level originally when I studied first-time middle-class mothers mm-hmm. and looked at how intensively they parent, the helicopter parenting idea, so that these children were being exposed to huge amounts of language, huge amounts of literacy. They were being taken to music classes and yoga classes and swimming classes all by the age of 6 months, and how that then was going to have an impact on them in later life. Mm-hmm. So that was my original research. Now, of course, that's okay when you've only got one child in the home.
Exactly.
But how do you keep that up when you've got three or four? It's unsustainable. So
yes,
birth order has an impact. From there, I started to look at some of the large-scale statistical surveys that have been done. They've mainly been done in the US, the UK, and mainland Europe. And they do show that birth order does affect educational attainment and then has a an effect on your chances of getting earnings.
Right. Yeah. Your any personal anecdotes? You come from a family of five, don't you?
I come from a family of five. Okay. I'm the fourth. And in some ways, though, I'm a pseudo-oldest child. Again, there's some research evidence on this. It's not just birth order that matters, but the spacing of children that matters. So between me and the sister above me, there are 4 years. And so if you look at our family, number one went off to Oxford University. Number four, me, went off to Oxford University. I was the pseudo oldest mm-hmm. because of that gap. What that meant was that I had a parent at home with me for those first early critical years of my life who was able to give me intensive one-to-one attention. They weren't running around after a baby or attending to an older toddler at the same time. So that's what the evidence suggests is critical.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is, in all that research about how you need to pay full attention to your children before the age of six or seven, is that it's the crucial time for children.
It's
and how
critical.
They develop.
Yeah. It's not the only time that matters. Parental practices later on in education also matter. So parental involvement has been shown to affect educational attainment as well. Again, it's then related to how many children you have. So that if you've only got one child, it's easy to be involved in their yeah. curricular activities, much easier. Whereas if you've got several, inevitably you're diluting your efforts.
Okay, so are you saying then if you only have one child, they are very, very advantaged?
They're advantaged academically. That doesn't mean that they have all the advantages. There have been a number of studies that have suggested that middle children mm-hmm. have a social advantage. So the oldest and often the youngest as well have the academic advantage. They've also been shown to have psychological attributes like conscientiousness. They're meant to be more religious and so on. Essentially, they're more conformist to parental values. The middle child is more of the rebel. So having said that older children tend to be more successful and then have higher earnings, middle children tend to be more successful in the creative industries
right.
and have better developed social skills. They have lower rates of divorce, for example, and so on.
Wow.
Yeah.
So the middle child syndrome, does that really exist?
Yes, it does. But with all of these, it's yes and no. Mm-hmm. Statistically, it exists. But these are from large scale studies. And also, they've been from predominantly UK, US, European studies. Now, it's not quite the same in Malaysia. Yeah. In Malaysia, parenting practices are very different than parenting practices in Europe. In Malaysia, family structures are very different. The extended family matters far more here. People are much more likely to be spending time with cousins and other relatives, so that you might have a child who is an oldest sibling, but is spending extensive amounts of periods with older cousins, younger cousins. So it's a different relationship. Mm-hmm. So there are different factors, and there actually isn't the evidence from this culture that backs it up at this stage. That research has yet to be done.
Right. So the whole idea of birth order then, nothing is cast in stone then?
No.
As you said, it's very subjective.
It's not just that it's subjective, but it's for parents to create that social environment of the home, and also for teachers to work with them on creating that the advantages and disadvantages so that they extend to all. I've said so far that oldest children have an academic advantage but a social disadvantage. One of the concerns in the UK, for example, is that approximately one in three children are now predicted to be growing up in only child households.
Right.
What does that mean for all the lack of social opportunities that they're having? Should the education system be stepping in and stepping up the development of social skills if they're no longer happening in the home?
And when you talk about social skills, what are you referring to? Because I'm just thinking, I mean, even single only children actually go to school, they need to socialize and things like that, so they can actually build those bonds in school and, you know, with others. But so when you talk about building social skills, what exactly are you referring to?
They don't get the hours that the child from a larger home gets. The child from a larger home gets all of that opportunity at school, but they also get it at home. So the middle child has to relate to both older children and to younger children. So they get opportunities to be leaders.
Right.
They boss around their younger siblings, but they also are expected to be followers and then have to negotiate with their bossy older brother or sister for their own space. So they're developing a range of social skills.
You know, you're a mother of four daughters.
Yeah, that's right.
What are your observations and how does that affect how you parent? And, you know, just to digress a little, Lucy, I remember reading some time ago that every parent, whether you like it or not, actually has the tendency to favour one child. Do you think that's true?
No. But I think that children think that it's true. My children are convinced at any one time that I'm favoring someone. And they're always convinced, all four of them are convinced that it's not them, that it's someone else. So I hope that means that I'm actually being fair. It's very hard to see in individuals. I could look at my children and say, oh, my second oldest is very articulate. She is very bolshy, I guess, for want of a better word. She does buck the trends. But that's her. It doesn't mean that she became like that because she was a second born. What the statistical data does tell us, though, is that we perhaps have to be alert to some of these potential issues, so that as a parent of four children, I try to be sensitive to the fact that numbers two and three might feel lost in the middle, mm-hmm. and that they need as much one-to-one time as I can generate for them, which is pretty hard when you've got four kids and you're working. So I try and focus as much one-to-one time as I can on them, because otherwise they might lose out. Mm-hmm. So similarly, someone who's only got one child might want to pay extra attention to developing those social skills. So the surveys are just sensitizing us to ideas about how we might parent.
Okay. So as you said, your ultimate aim is actually to, in education, as far as schools and for parents to understand and work around these issues. I mean, if we didn't understand any of this, I mean, what difference would it make? I mean, what are some of the mistakes as parents that we can make? I mean, is it failure to understand, or, you know, how does it help us to understand some of the things that you're saying right now?
Well, research is always interesting for me as an end in itself, that it gives us a way of understanding the world and understanding our own experiences. So I find it interesting to understand myself and who I am. I think that also for teachers, you need to be aware of where your children come from. Teachers and parents need to be working much more closely together in a partnership, rather than the parents taking the children to school, leaving them there, and thinking that's that, and the two never interact mm-hmm. or meet. It shows us how important it is for teachers to be aware of what's happening in the home, because it is going to affect how those children behave in the classroom and how they do academically.
Okay, so everybody needs to be on the same page. People need to understand about the whole birth order thing. But how much of it boils down to maybe social and economic factors as well, Lucy, instead of just birth orders?
They are very important. One of the things we talked about here is birth order, but of course related to that is family size. And family size is related to socioeconomic status. Yeah. So people from lower socioeconomic status on average have larger families than people from higher socioeconomic status. And that means that those children in some ways lose out because their parents can't afford the same opportunities for them. So yes, socioeconomic status is extremely important.
Extremely.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is, yes, birth order matters, but other things matter just as much, if not more. Parental practices in education, socioeconomic status, all sorts of things like that. Yeah.
It's all about the awareness, really.
Yeah.
Coming up, we'll find out more about birth order. If you have a question for Lucy, send it through 016-201-9000, or you can tweet BFM Radio. Coming up, you know, I want to find out, in terms of research that suggests maybe firstborns are more likely to choose firstborns as spouses, and so on and so forth. If you have a question, send it through. That's coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the show. It's The Bigger Picture. Dr. Lucy Bailey, Assistant Professor. She's a Sociologist of Education. We're discussing birth order. Done a whole lot of research, Lucy, in this whole area. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to ask you, I mean, just to build on what we spoke about in terms of schooling and socioeconomic status, and just to go back in time a little, I'm going to play you a short clip, which I did a similar show with former editor of the Journal of Psychology, Peter Mitchell, and this is what he had to say.
Educators realised that they were going to have to select children. They went, in the early days, they weren't able to educate all of the children because they had limited resources in those days. And so they realised that they could only educate some children, especially to a higher level of education. And what they wanted to do was to be able to select children who are most likely to benefit from education. And now, they could do this just based on an interview or just based on the impression of the child or talking to the family. But in fairness to those people, they decided that the best way to do that this was by objectively measuring a person's potential intelligence.
Can you do that? How effective is that? measuring a person's intelligence based on birth order?
It depends on what you mean by intelligence. So, for example, intelligence and IQ is socially constructed. So how we measure it and the average level varies across cultures. There is some evidence, and one study was done, which suggested that a child's IQ dropped by 10 points on the birth of a younger sibling.
Wow.
Sounds worrying.
Yes.
However, this luckily was longitudinal research, and it showed that that gap had actually disappeared by the age of 17.
Okay.
So although there was some temporary drop in IQ, it all leveled out in the end. So what is IQ? How can IQ drop like that? It suggests that it's not actually innate, that there is a social dimension to IQ itself.
Okay, there is a huge social dimension, really. What about research that suggests that firstborns are more likely to choose firstborns as a spouse, and so on and so forth?
Okay, I have read popular accounts of that. I'm not aware of any academic literature on that, looking at that sort of from an academic, thorough, rigorous piece of research. So perhaps I should pass on that question. Having said that, I guess we are attracted to people who share our background or share insights. So perhaps it just suggests that they have had a similar education, a similar background.
Okay. I think we've got somebody who's texted in a comment, right? And I suppose it sort of jives with what you said about, you know, second and third children. I come from a family of four girls and two boys, and I am the youngest. My elder sister and I are high achievers, while number 2 to 5 are just plodding along, preferring to do social work or the arts or other less financially worthwhile pursuits. And now I know why.
That's great.
Yes, fantastic. Thank you. At least we were of some help to you. Are there differences between female and male firstborns?
Well, there is some research from places in Africa, for example, from Kenya, to suggest that more attention is given to firstborn males, and in fact, the older brothers in general, so brothers 1, 2, and 3, and that they're at a nutritional advantage. I haven't seen data on that coming from the UK or Europe, or indeed Malaysia.
Okay. And when parents are looking to treat their children equally, how can they encourage the positive traits traditionally associated with older or only children in the younger siblings?
Okay, well, let's not forget that as well, being a younger child and being a middle child confers advantages. So the middle children may be rebels, but they're also the people who can think outside the box. They're the people who perhaps challenge the parents more of the time. Well, as the economy changes, perhaps that's not a bad thing to be that team player, to be the person who can question how things are done. So we may actually see that being a middle child ends up conferring financial advantages in the future. Mm-hmm. So I would be wary of trying to level it up now, but actually perhaps disadvantaging your child. But I do think that the underlying issue here is about parental involvement in education, defined widely, not just in schooling, but about the language opportunities that children are given, their exposure to language. Studies have suggested that the most advantaged 10% of the population, as compared to the most disadvantaged 10% of the population, they have 10 times as much exposure to words, just the sheer number of words, by the time they first reach school. What an enormous difference mm-hmm. that is in then how you can introduce those children to literacy and so on. So it is about that parental involvement and parental attention. So okay. it's keeping our eye on that.
Sure. And in a world where, you know, parental involvement is getting less and less.
Mm. Because of pressures on parents.
Exactly. Yeah. And we seem to be, as you said, palming out this job to other people, whether it's going for extra tuition class or, you know, going for speech and drama and things like that, and hoping, you know, things will work. But what are your thoughts on that? I mean, is that something we should be doing, considering that we all need to go out and work these days?
There's two ways of looking at this. It depends on what else those children might be doing. If you're asking me, are extracurricular activities valuable? Yes, mm-hmm. they do help children to develop more social skills. They do help them to develop creative skills and so on. There's huge amounts of data to suggest that if you learn a musical instrument, it improves your academic achievement and so on. But if that's coming at the price of parental attention, then no. So if parents are working hard, earning more, but all that money is being poured into this extra tuition and the ballet classes and the yoga yeah. classes and so on, then actually the children might be ending up with some level of disadvantage.
Okay, I'm going to ask you this question. How do we start? Okay, if we have this terrible routine every day and we know at the back of our heads that we need to spend a lot more time with our children, how do we start? Lucy, I mean, would you have advice as to how we can get our children involved just for 1 hour a day? How do we interact with them? How do we educate them in the best way possible?
Okay, firstly, 1 hour a day won't make the difference, but it is just a question of going home tonight and asking your child how the day went. And when you said to them, what did you do at school today? And they've said nothing and given you no answer at all. And that's always what my children tell me. Then you have to probe further. You need to know what their timetable is so that you can say, hey, I saw that you had swimming today. How did that go? Or weren't you meant to be doing French? Do you know any words in French? Teach me something in French. Mm-hmm. So it can be as simple as just talking to the children. The more curricular involvement you have, the more likely you are to improve their educational attainment. Yes, the PTA, yes, all of those extra stuff. They are shown to have behavioral benefits for children, but the most important thing is to know what your children are doing in the classroom and to support them with that okay. as best you can.
And of course, we want to avoid being that helicopter parent, as you said.
Yes.
and that's a very Asian thing to do. How do we let go?
Well, trust the teacher and work with the teacher so that it is, as I said before, it is a partnership. One thing that research has also shown is that if you go and complain about your child's school lots, if you're talking about, oh, you know, those parents, the teacher did this and the teacher did that, then that can actually have an adverse effect on the child's own commitment to schooling. So it's about being supportively involved with your teacher.
Mm-hmm. I also think it's about having trust in your own child. Really?
Yes, giving them some autonomy.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And not to just, you know, assume that they can't do it. Mm-hmm. And I noticed a lot of stay-at-home mums and, you know, tend to do that because you feel that that's what you should be doing. So then we need to strike that balance between being the helicopter parent as well as totally neglecting. Start with 1 hour a day.
Yes. And I think that everyone gets the balance wrong some of the time. So all we're trying to do is get it right more of the time, or as much of the time as we can manage.
Okay. We have another question here for you, Lucy. Could you advise on a child's exposure to multiple languages at a young age?
Well, that's great. It's really good if you can expose the child to multiple languages. The most important thing to be is to be consistent in who uses that language in the home. So, for example, if you have a mother that speaks one language, a father that speaks a second language, be consistent in their use of that language. If you have one parent who's continually switching between the languages, code switching, mm-hmm. then it's much harder for the child to sort out and acquire language. You might expect to have a slight language delay with them acquiring a language, but they rapidly catch that up. So even if you get to the age of two and you notice that your child's peers are perhaps using more words, have a little bit more fluency than your child, don't panic. They will get there, and that's what the research shows.
Does birth order play a role at all in how quickly children pick up, the arts or social skills and things like that?
No, I see no evidence on that as far as language acquisition goes. Children acquire language from each other as well as from their parents. So perhaps it's also about creating opportunities for them to acquire the right language from their siblings.
That can be a double-edged yes. sword, really. We also spoke to Peter Mitchell, the former editor of the Journal of Psychology, on social intelligence, and this is what he had to say.
Children who belong to large families are likely to show better ability than those from smaller families in interpreting what other people are thinking.
Okay.
So it's quite a surprising finding, particularly children who have older siblings, so not necessarily the firstborn. The secondborn has an advantage. The thirdborn has a bigger advantage.
There you go. Large families. And what do you consider large?
Well, again, this depends on the culture you're in as to how large is large. And it's very different in different parts of the world. But yes, you've basically got an exponential growth of the relationships that those children are exposed to. So when my first daughter came along, she had to have a relationship with her mother and her father. So two central relationships. By the time the last child comes along, you know, my fourth daughter, she's got relationships with two parents. She's got the relationships with all three of her older siblings. And she's also got all of their interrelationships to observe. And I can see her little mind chuntering along and figuring it out as she goes. She's got so much yeah. rich sociological data happening in her own home.
Yeah. Even between the, if you have two children, you always find the number two sort of adopting this attitude of survival of the fittest.
Yeah.
Is there a reason for that? I mean, is that competition or, you know, what is it?
No.
Especially when you know you're not favoring any one of them, you know. It's just this, I have to do it first. I have to have everything that she has, you know, that sort of thing. Where's that stemming from?
Well, yes. Andy Murray's mother, when he won Wimbledon, claimed that he'd managed that because he was a younger sibling. Because she said that he was always trying to keep up with his older brother. So he'd had to kind of accelerate through. And obviously, they were both superb tennis players. They both won different competitions at Wimbledon, but he's been the men's champion now. Whether that's actually bound out by the wider data, I can't say, but mm-hmm. there's some anecdotal evidence there.
I'm sure. I mean, Andy Murray took ages to win the Wimbledon at home. And he finally did, and hats off to him, really. A psychologist we had on the show previously has said that as much as 70% of our IQ or raw potential is genetically determined or inherited. Would you agree with that?
I would
70%
agree.
70% is very high.
Yes, I would agree that there is a huge genetic component to who we are and what we do and our personalities. However, 30% is still an awful lot that you can change. You can still start with 30% of difference and create a huge difference between people. You know, people who only have 10 IQ points difference, they can end up with completely different life trajectories. So as a sociologist, yes, I know that nature's there, but I want to concentrate on what I can change, mm-hmm. what I can improve, and I guess that's what drives me at work each day.
Okay. Sibling rivalries, does that help with the development of a child? And sometimes this can extend to rivalries even in adulthood, you know.
Absolutely.
Where do you draw the line as far as healthy sibling rivalry is concerned?
As a parent, you need to make sure that they are respectful rivalries so that they don't end up, obviously, in physical rivalries and that they use respectful language to each other, but sibling rivalry I would always expect, and it's part of that social development that children have to go through. So they are competing for your attention, and they feel that they're competing for your attention. They're right, essentially. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. It's kind of an intelligent response on their part.
Sure. If you could choose your birth order again, Lucy, would you still want to be the number four in the family out of five?
Yes, I think I would. I think I'm happy with how things have gone. And you never know. As I say, if you change one thing, you've got this butterfly effect. So I could be a completely different person in a completely different country.
Yeah.
If anything else had been different. Yeah. So,
It's your whole outlook.
Number four. I am number four.
The Chinese don't like it. Number four ain't the best number in feng shui, for an example. As you said, look at it on the brighter side. Is the birth order debate totally irrelevant to China? Because we do know China has the one child policy. Does having an entire generation of little emperors actually present different challenges altogether for China in terms of parenting and education?
Yes, I think that it does. I think that it means that the education system is going to have to step up to the mark and introduce more attention to those social skills. So perhaps it would be that you would want the children to be entering social environments at a younger age, possibly with parents in attendance too. Perhaps it would be that you're having to pay more attention to social skills in the classroom. So there's more discussion with the children about rules and boundaries and how they're created, because they won't be getting that in the home.
Yeah.
Again, it can be very successful when children are part of the negotiation of rules. They tend to do that in large families. Mm-hmm. At schools, the rules tend to be given, so they wouldn't necessarily get that negotiation. Mm-hmm. So perhaps that needs to change.
Don't you think governments need to understand this in order to come up with education policies to cater for such knowledge that, you know, they really should know about?
I think they really should give support to parents, and I think they should support parents in being involved in education, and that would benefit all parents. And that's about creating opportunities that work with parents' working lives, mm-hmm. Particularly parents who perhaps are working fixed shifts, aren't able to adjust their working hours to go into school, and so on. I'm in a privileged position. I'm a professor in a university. I can go and hang around my children's school and applaud them when they're doing things in the middle of the day. Many people can't.
Yep.
So it's about making education sensitive to that.
Right. And what do you do with all this research that you've done? I mean, do you pass it on to someone else to, you know, build on, or, you know, even propose policies to government maybe?
Two things, publish and publicize. Mm-hmm. So one thing is that we, as an academic community, we share all our ideas with each other through journals, through books and so on. And secondly, I do see it as part of my role to visit schools, to speak to teachers, to speak to parents, to let them know what the research shows about the most effective ways to get involved in education.
Okay. And we have another question here. How do we advise children who come to us and are convinced they are not favored by a teacher?
By a teacher rather than a parent.
Well, and that happens too.
Oh, yes, it does happen too. Children might be, I really don't believe children are favored by their parents, and parents love children in different ways, and they love them for who they are. They get exasperated with them at some times, but they do love them. That's the overwhelming majority. Teachers could favor as well. When I've seen teachers struggling with some children's behavior, I have seen them communicate to the children perhaps negative evaluations of their personalities and their behaviors. And I think what I would recommend for parents to do is to go and have that conversation with the school, and to be just to let them know that this is what the child is saying, so that the teacher can respond to that. The teacher might not have been aware at the time that this was the message they were communicating to the class. So it's about keeping those channels of communication open. If you don't go and tell the teachers what the children and you think's happening in the class, they can't respond to it.
Okay. I always worry about teachers victimizing children. Mm. So when they do come back with complaints like this, teachers not favoring me, my response, I'll be really honest, Lucy, is tough luck. The world ain't wonderful. You need to learn to cope with this. You need to understand that the teacher's not going to like everyone, and people in general, not everyone's going to like you. And you need to learn how to gain that respect from them. But, I mean, is that
you
really
need to cope with a range of social situations, but you certainly shouldn't be having to deal with a teacher that gives you the impression that there's something wrong with you as a person. They might not like your behavior. They might not like something you did on a particular day. And it's good for them to say that to a child, but they shouldn't reduce a child's self-esteem. That's important.
Okay. And do we need to also look out for how often it happens, or if there is a trend, you know, that sort of thing? Or it could just be a one-off.
I think if a child is saying that to their parent, then you should go and have that conversation with the school. The school needs to know, because there's probably a whole backstory before the child went and expressed it to you.
Okay. Your final message, Lucy, on birth order?
To parents, I would not worry too much whether you have an only child or two children or three or four. It confers advantages and disadvantages. Be sensitive to what might be the advantages and disadvantages for certain children, and try and counterbalance them through your own behaviour.
Thank you very much for joining me today. Dr. Lucy Bailey, Assistant Professor, Sociologist of Education, on Birth Order on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.